The door swung in, and a tall, big-faced man with gray eyes came forward hurriedly. Max and Jan and the Peaches stood to one side. Bigger stared at the man's face. It teased him. Then he remembered. It was Buckley, the man whose face he had seen the workman pasting upon a billboard a few mornings ago. Bigger listened to the men talk, feeling in the tones of their voices a deep hostility toward one another.
So you're horning in again, huh, Max?
This boy's my client, and he's signing no confessions, Max said.
What the hell do I want with his confession? Buckley asked. We've got enough evidence on him to put him in a dozen electric chairs.
I'll see that his rights are protected, Max said.
Hell, man, you can't do him any good.
Max turned to Bigger. Don't let these people scare you, Bigger. Bigger heard, but did not answer.
What in hell you Reds can get out of bothering with a black thing like that, God only knows,
Buckley said, rubbing his hands across his eyes.
You're afraid that you won't be able to kill this boy before the April elections if we handle his case, aren't you, Buckley?
Jan asked. Buckley whirled.
Why in God's name can't you pick out somebody decent to defend sometimes? Somebody who'll appreciate it. Why do you Reds take up with scum like this?
You and your tactics have forced us to defend this boy, Max said.
What do you mean? Buckley asked.
If you had not dragged the name of the Communist Party into this murder, I'd not be here, Max said.
Hell, this boy signed the name of the Communist Party to the kidnap note.
I realize that, Max said. The boy got the idea from the newspapers. I'm defending this boy because I'm convinced that men like you made him what he is. His trying to blame the communists for his crime was a natural reaction for him. He had heard men like you lie about the communists so much that he believed them. If I can make the people of this country understand why this boy acted like he did, I'll be doing more than defending him.
Buckley laughed, bit off the tip of a fresh cigar, lit it, and stood puffing. He advanced to the center of the room, cocked his head to one side, took the cigar out of his mouth, and squinted at Bigger.
Boy, did you ever think you'd be as important a man as you are right now?
Bigger had been on the verge of accepting the friendship of Jan and Max, and now this man stood before him. What did the puny friendship of Jan and Max mean in the face of a million men like Buckley?
I'm the state's attorney, Buckley said, walking from one end of the room to the other.
His hat was on the back of his head. A white silk handkerchief peeped from the breast pocket of his black coat. He paused by the cot, towering over Bigger. How soon were they going to kill him, Bigger wondered. The breath of warm hope which Jan and Max had blown so softly upon him turned to frost under Buckley's cold gaze.
Boy, I'd like to give you a piece of good advice. I'm going to be honest with you and tell you that you don't have to talk to me unless you want to. And I'll tell you that whatever you say to me might be used against you in court, see? But boy, you're caught. That's the first thing you want to understand. We know what you've done. We got the evidence. So you might as well talk.
He'll decide that with me, Max said.
Buckley and Max faced each other.
Listen, Max, you're wasting your time. You'll never get this boy off in a million years. Nobody can commit a crime against a family like the Daltons and sneak out of it. Those poor old parents are going to be in that courtroom to see that this boy burns. This boy killed the only thing they had. If you want to save your face, you and your buddy can leave now, and the papers won't know you were in here.
I reserve the right to determine whether I should defend him or not, Max said.
Listen, Max, you think I'm trying to hoodwink you, don't you?
Buckley asked, turning and going to the door.
Let me show you something.
A policeman opened the door, and Buckley said,
Tell him to come in.
Okay.
The room was silent. Bigger sat on the cot, looking at the floor. He hated this. If anything could be done in his behalf, he himself wanted to do it, not others. The more he saw others exerting themselves, the emptier he felt. He saw the policeman fling the door wide open. Mr. and Mrs. Dalton walked in slowly and stood. Mr. Dalton was looking at him, his face white. Bigger half rose in dread, then sat again, his eyes lifted, but unseeing. He sank back to the cot. Swiftly, Buckley crossed the room and shook hands with Mr. Dalton, and turning to Mrs. Dalton, said,
I'm dreadfully sorry, madam.
Bigger saw Mr. Dalton look at him, then at Buckley.
Did he say who was in this thing with him?
Mr. Dalton asked.
He's just come out of it, Buckley said, and he's got a lawyer now.
I have charge of his defense, Max said.
Bigger saw Mr. Dalton look briefly at Jan.
Bigger, you're a foolish boy if you don't tell who was in this thing with you,
Mr. Dalton said. Bigger tightened and did not answer. Max walked over to Bigger and placed a hand on his shoulder.
I will talk to him, Mr. Dalton, Max said.
I'm not here to bully this boy, Mr. Dalton said. But it'll go easier with him if he tells all he knows.
There was silence. The preacher came forward slowly, hat in hand, and stood in front of Mr. Dalton.
I'm a preacher of the gospel, sir, he said. And I'm mighty sorry about what's done happened to your daughter. I knows of your good work, sir, and the likes of this shouldn't have come to you.
Mr. Dalton sighed and said wearily,
Thank you.
The best thing you can do is help us, Buckley said, turning to Max. A grave wrong has been done to two people who help Negroes more than anybody I know.
I sympathize with you, Mr. Dalton, Max said. But killing this boy isn't going to help you or any of us.
I tried to help him, Mr. Dalton said.
We wanted to send him to school, said Mrs. Dalton faintly.
I know, Max said. But those things don't touch the fundamental problem involved here. This boy comes from an oppressed people. Even if he's done wrong, we must take that into consideration.
I want you to know that my heart is not bitter, Mr. Dalton said. What this boy has done will not influence my relations with the Negro people. Why, only today I sent a dozen ping-pong tables to the Southside Boys Club.
Mr. Dalton, Max exclaimed, coming forward suddenly.
My God, man. Will ping-pong keep men from murdering? Can't you see? Even after losing your daughter, you're going to keep going in the same direction. Don't you grant as much life-feeling to other men as you have? Could ping-pong have kept you from making your millions? This boy and millions like him want a meaningful life, not ping-pong.
What do you want me to do? Mr. Dalton asked coldly. Do you want me to die and atone for a suffering I never caused? I'm not responsible for the state of this world. I'm doing all one man can. I suppose you want me to take my money and fling it out to the millions who have nothing?
No. Not that, Max said.
If you felt that millions of others experience life as deeply as you, but differently, you'd see that what you're doing doesn't help. Something of a more fundamental nature.
Communism!
Buckley boomed, pulling down the corners of his lips. Gentlemen,
Let's don't be childish. This boy is going on trial for his life. My job is to enforce the laws of this state.
Buckley's voice stopped as the door opened and the policeman looked inside.
What is it?
Buckley asked.
The boy's folks are here.
Bigger cringed. Not this. Not here. Not now. He did not want his mother to come in here now, with these people standing round. He looked about with a wild, pleading expression. Buckley watched him, then turned back to the policeman.
They have a right to see him, Buckley said. Let him come in.
Though he sat, Bigger felt his legs trembling. He was so tense in body and mind that when the door swung in, he bounded up and stood in the middle of the room. He saw his mother's face. He wanted to run to her and push her back through the door. She was standing still, one hand upon the doorknob. The other hand clutched a frayed pocketbook, which she dropped and ran to him, throwing her arms about him, crying,
"My baby!"
Bigger's body was stiff with dread and indecision. He felt his mother's arms tight about him, and he looked over her shoulder and saw Vera and Buddy come slowly inside and stand looking about timidly. Beyond them, he saw Gus and G.H. and Jack, their mouths open in awe and fear. Vera's lips were trembling, and Buddy's hands were clenched. Buckley, the preacher, Jan, Max, Mr. and Mrs. Dalton stood along the wall behind him, looking on silently. Bigger wanted to whirl and blot them from sight. The kind words of Jan and Max were forgotten now. He felt that all of the white people in the room were measuring every inch of his weakness. He identified himself with his family and felt their naked shame under the eyes of white folks. While looking at his brother and sister and feeling his mother's arms about him, while knowing that Jack and G.H. and Gus were standing awkwardly in the doorway, staring at him in curious disbelief, while being conscious of all this, Bigger felt a wild and outlandish conviction surge in him.
They ought to be glad.
It was a strange but strong feeling, springing from the very depths of his life. Had he not taken fully upon himself the crime of being black? Had he not done the thing which they dreaded above all others? And they ought not stand here and pity him, cry over him, but look at him and go home, contented, feeling that their shame was washed away.
Oh, Bigger, son, his mother wailed. We've been so worried. We ain't slept a single night. The police is there all the time. They stand outside our door. They watch and follow us everywhere. Son, son.
Bigger heard her sobs, but what could he do? She ought not to have come here. Buddy came over to him, fumbling with his cap.
Listen, Bigger, if you didn't do it, just tell me and I'll fix them. I'll get a gun and kill 4 or 5 of them.
The room gasped. Bigger turned his head quickly and saw that the white faces along the wall were shocked and startled.
Don't talk that way, Buddy, the mother sobbed. You want me to die right now? I can't stand no more of this. You mustn't talk that way. We in enough trouble now.
Don't let them treat you bad, Bigger,
Buddy said stoutly. Bigger wanted to comfort them in the presence of the white folks, but did not know how. Desperately, he cast about for something to say. Hate and shame boiled in him against the people behind his back. He tried to think of words that would defy them, words that would let them know that he had a world and life of his own, in spite of them. And at the same time, he wanted those words to stop the tears of his mother and sister, to quiet and soothe the anger of his brother. He longed to stop those tears and that anger, because he knew that they were futile, that the people who stood along the wall, back of him, had the destiny of him and his family in their hands.
"Aw, Ma, don't y'all worry none," he said, amazed at his own words.
He was possessed by a queer, imperious, nervous energy.
"I'll be out of this in no time,"
His mother gave him an incredulous stare. Bigger turned his head again and looked feverishly and defiantly at the white faces along the wall. They were staring at him in surprise. Buckley's lips were twisted in a faint smile. Jan and Max looked dismayed. Mrs. Dalton, white as the wall behind her, listened, open-mouthed. The preacher and Mr. Dalton were shaking their heads sadly. Bigger knew that no one in the room, except Buddy, believed him. His mother turned her face away and cried. Vera knelt upon the floor and covered her face with her hands.
Bigger.
His mother's voice came low and quiet. She caught his face between the palms of her trembling hands.
Bigger,
she said.
Tell me, is there anything we can do?
He knew that his mother's question had been prompted by his telling her that he would get out of all this. He knew that they had nothing. They were so poor that they were depending upon public charity to eat. He was ashamed of what he had done. He should have been honest with them. It had been a wild and foolish impulse that had made him try to appear strong and innocent before them. Maybe they would remember him only by those foolish words after they had killed him. His mother's eyes were sad, skeptical, but kind, patient, waiting for his answer. Yes, he had to wipe out that lie, not only so that they might know the truth, but to redeem himself in the eyes of those white faces behind his back along the white wall. He was lost, but he would not cringe. He would not lie, not in the presence of that white mountain looming behind him.
There ain't nothing, Ma. But I'm all right, he mumbled.
There was silence. Buddy lowered his eyes. Vera sobbed louder. She seemed so little and helpless. She should not have come here. Her sorrow accused him. If he could only make her go home. It was precisely to keep from feeling this hate and shame and despair that he had always acted hard and tough toward them. And now he was without defense. His eyes roved the room, seeing Gus and G.H. and Jack. They saw him looking at them and came forward.
I'm sorry, Bigger,
Jack said, his eyes on the floor.
They picked us up too,
G.H. said, as though trying to comfort Bigger with the fact.
But Mr. Airlone and Mr. Max got us out. They tried to make us tell about a lot of things we didn't do, but we wouldn't tell.
Anything we could do, Bigger?
Gus asked.
I'm all right, Bigger said.
Say, when you go, take Ma home, will you?
Sure, sure,
they said. Again there was silence, and Bigger's taut nerves ached to fill it up.
How you like them sewing classes at the Y, Vera?
He asked. Vera tightened her hands over her face.
Bigger,
his mother sobbed, trying to talk through her tears.
Bigger, honey, she won't go to school no more. She says the other girls look at and make ashamed.
He had lived and acted on the assumption that he was alone, and now he saw that he had not been. What he had done made others suffer. No matter how much he would long for them to forget him, they would not be able to. His family was a part of him, not only in blood, but in spirit. He sat on the cot and his mother knelt at his feet. Her face was lifted to his. Her eyes were empty, eyes that looked upward when the last hope of earth had failed.
I'm praying for you, son. That's all I can do now,
she said.
The Lord knows I did all I could for you and your sister and brother. I scrubbed and washed and ironed from morning till night, day in and day out, as long as I had strength in my old body. I did all I know how, son. And if I left anything undone, it's just 'cause I didn't know. It's just 'cause your poor old ma couldn't see, son. When I heard the news of what happened, I got on my knees and turned my eyes to God, and asked him if I raised you wrong. I asked him to let me bear your burden if I did wrong by you. Honey, your poor old ma can't do nothing now. I'm old, and this is too much for me. I'm at the end of my rope. Listen, son. Your poor old ma wants you to promise her one thing. Honey, when ain't nobody around you, when you alone, get on your knees and tell God everything. Ask him to guide you. That's all you can do now. Son, promise me you'll go to him.
Amen, the preacher intoned fervently. Forgive me, Ma, Bigger said.
Son, I can't forget you. You're my boy. I brought you into this world.
Forgive me, Ma.
Son, I'm worried about you. I can't help it. You got your soul to save. I won't be able to rest easy as long as I'm on this earth if I thought you had gone away from us without asking God for help. Bigger, we had a hard time in this world, but through it all, we've been together, ain't we?
Yelsom, he whispered.
Son, there's a place where we can be together again in the great by and by. God's done fixed us so we can. He's fixed a meeting place for us, a place where we can live without fear. No matter what happens to us here, we can be together in God's heaven. Bigger, your old ma's begging you to promise her you'll pray.
She's telling you right, son, the preacher said. Forget me, Ma, Bigger said.
Don't you want to see your old ma again, son?
Slowly, he stood up and lifted his hands and tried to touch his mother's face and tell her yes. And as he did so, something screamed deep down in him that it was a lie, that seeing her after they killed him would never be. But his mother believed it was her last hope. It was what had kept her going through the long years. And she was now believing it all the harder because of the trouble he had brought upon her. His hands finally touched her face, and he said with a sigh, knowing that it would never be, knowing that his heart did not believe, knowing that when he died, it would be over, forever. I'll pray, Ma. Vera ran to him and embraced him. Buddy looked grateful. His mother was so happy that all she could do was cry. Jack and G.H. and Gus smiled. Then his mother stood up and encircled him with her arms.
Come here, Vera, she whimpered.
Vera came.
Come here, Buddy.
Buddy came.
Now put your arms around your brother, she said.
They stood in the middle of the floor, crying with their arms locked around Bigger. Bigger held his face stiff, hating them and himself, feeling the white people along the wall watching. His mother mumbled a prayer, to which the preacher chanted.
Lord, here we is, maybe for the last time. You gave me these children, Lord, and told me to raise them. If I failed, Lord, I did the best I could.
Amen.
These poor children's been with me a long time, and they's all I got. Lord, please let me see them again after the sorrow and suffering of this world.
Hear her, Lord.
Lord, please, let me see them where I can love them in peace. Let me see them again beyond the grave.
Have mercy, Jesus.
You said you'd heed prayer, Lord, and I'm asking this in the name of your son.
Amen and God bless you, Sister Thomas, the preacher said.
This ends Disc 10. Native Son, Disc 11.
They took their arms from round Bigger, silently, slowly, then turned their faces away, as though their weakness made them ashamed in the presence of powers greater than themselves.
We're leaving you now with God, Bigger, his mother said. Be sure and pray, son.
They kissed him. Buckley came forward. "You'll have to go now, Mrs. Thomas," he said. He turned to Mr. and Mrs. Dalton. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Dalton, I didn't mean to keep you standing there so long, but you see how things are." Bigger saw his mother straighten suddenly and stare at the blind white woman.
"Is you Mrs. Dalton?"
she asked. Mrs. Dalton moved nervously, lifted her thin white hands and tilted her head. Her mouth came open, and Mr. Dalton placed an arm about her.
"Yes,"
Mrs. Dalton whispered. "Oh, Mrs. Dalton, come right this way," Buckley said hurriedly.
"No, please,"
Mrs. Dalton said.
"What is it, Mrs. Thomas?"
Bigger's mother ran and knelt on the floor at Mrs. Dalton's feet.
"Please, ma'am," she wailed. "Please don't let him kill my boy. You know how a mother feels. Please, ma'am, we live in your house. They done asked us to move. We ain't got nothing."
Bigger was paralyzed with shame. He felt violated.
"Ma,"
he shouted, more in shame than anger. Max and Jan ran to the black woman and tried to lift her up.
"It's all right, Mrs. Thomas," Max said. "Come with me."
"Wait,"
Mrs. Dalton said.
"Please, ma'am, don't let him kill my boy. He ain't never had a chance. He's just a poor boy. Don't let him kill him. I'll work for you for the rest of my life. I'll do anything you say, ma'am,"
the mother sobbed. Mrs. Dalton stooped slowly, her hands trembling in the air. She touched the mother's head.
"There's nothing I can do now,"
Mrs. Dalton said calmly.
"It's out of my hands. I did all I could when I wanted to give your boy a chance at life. You're not to blame for this. You must be brave. Maybe it's better." "If you speak to him, they'll listen to you, ma'am,"
the mother sobbed.
"Tell him to have mercy on my boy." "Mrs. Thomas, it's too late for me to do anything now,"
Mrs. Dalton said.
"You must not feel like this. You have your other children to think of." "I know you hate us, ma'am. You lost your daughter." "No, no, I don't hate you,"
Mrs. Dalton said. The mother crawled from Mrs. Dalton to Mr. Dalton.
"You's rich and powerful," she sobbed. "Spare me, my boy."
Max struggled with the black woman and got her to her feet. Bigger's shame for his mother amounted to hate. He stood with clenched fists, his eyes burning. He felt that in another moment he would have leaped at her.
"That's all right, Mrs. Thomas," Max said.
Mr. Dalton came forward.
"Mrs. Thomas, there's nothing we can do," he said. "This thing is out of our hands. Up to a certain point, we can help you, but beyond that, people must protect themselves. But you won't have to move. I'll tell them not to make you move."
The black woman sobbed. Finally, she quieted enough to speak.
"Thank you, sir. God knows I thank you."
She turned again toward Bigger, but Max led her from the room. Jan caught hold of Vera's arm and led her forward, then stopped in the doorway, looking at Jack and G.H. and Gus.
"You boys going to the south side?"
"Yes, sir,"
they said.
"Come on. I got a car downstairs. I'll take you."
"Yes, sir."
Buddy lingered, looking wistfully at Bigger.
"Goodbye, Bigger," he said.
"Goodbye, Buddy," Bigger mumbled.
The preacher passed Bigger and pressed his arm.
"God bless you, son."
They all left except Buckley. Bigger sat again upon the cot, weak and exhausted. Buckley stood over him.
"Now, Bigger, you see all the trouble you caused? Now I'd like to get this case out of the way as soon as possible. The longer you stay in jail, the more agitation there'll be for and against you. And that doesn't help you any? No matter who tells you it does. Boy, there's not but one thing for you to do, and that's to come clean. I know those Reds, Max and Erlone, have told you a lot of things about what they're going to do for you, but don't believe them. They're just after publicity, boy. Just after building themselves up at your expense, see? They can't do a damn thing for you. You're dealing with the law now. And if you let those Reds put a lot of fool ideas into your head, then you're gambling with your own life. Buckley stopped and relit his cigar. He cocked his head to one side, listening. You hear that? He asked softly. Bigger looked at him, puzzled. He listened, hearing a faint din. Come here, boy. I want to show you something, he said, rising and catching hold of Bigger's arm. Bigger was reluctant to follow him. Come on. Nobody's going to hurt you. Bigger followed him out of the door. There were several policemen standing on guard in the hallway. Buckley led Bigger to a window, through which he looked and saw the streets below crowded with masses of people in all directions. See that, boy? Those people would like to lynch you. That's why I'm asking you to trust me and talk to me. The quicker we get this thing over, the better for you. We're going to try to keep them from bothering you. But can't you see the longer they stay around here, the harder it'll be for us to handle them? Buckley let go of Bigger's arm and hoisted the window. A cold wind swept in, and Bigger heard a roar of voices. Involuntarily, he stepped backward. Would they break into the jail? Buckley shut the window and led him back to the room. He sat upon the cot, and Buckley sat opposite him. You look like an intelligent boy. You see what you're in. Tell me about this thing. Don't let those Reds fool you into saying you're not guilty. I'm talking to you as straight as I'd talk to a son of mine. Sign a confession and get this over with. Bigger said nothing. He sat looking at the floor. Was Jan mixed up in this? Bigger heard the faint, excited sound of mob voices coming through the concrete walls of the building. He proved an alibi and he's free. Tell me, did he leave you holding the bag? Bigger heard the faraway clang of a streetcar. If he made you do it, then sign a complaint against him. Bigger saw the shining tip of the man's black shoes, the sharp creases in his striped trousers, the clear, icy glinting of the eyeglasses upon his high, long nose. Boy, said Buckley in a voice so loud that Bigger flinched. Where's Bessie? Bigger's eyes widened. He had not thought of Bessie but once since his capture. Her death was unimportant beside that of Mary's. He knew that when they killed him, it would be for Mary's death, not Bessie's. Well, boy, we found her. You hit her with a brick. But she didn't die right away. Bigger's muscles jerked him to his feet. Bessie alive? But the voice droned on, and he sat down. She tried to get out of that air shaft, but she couldn't. She froze to death. We got the brick you hit her with. We got the blanket and the quilt and the pillows you took from her room. We got a letter from her purse she had written to you and hadn't mailed. A letter telling you she didn't want to go through with trying to collect the ransom money. You see, boy, we got you. Come on now. Tell me all about it. Bigger said nothing. He buried his face in his hand. You raped her, didn't you? Well, if you won't tell about Bessie, then tell me about that woman you raped and choked to death over on University Avenue last fall. Was the man trying to scare him? Or did he really think he had done other killings? Boy, you might just as well tell me. We've got a line on all you ever did.
And how about the girl you attacked in Jackson Park last summer? Listen, boy. When you were in your cell sleeping and wouldn't talk, we brought women in to identify you. Two women swore complaints against you. One was the sister of the woman you killed last fall, Mrs. Clinton. The other woman, Miss Ashton, says you attacked her last summer by climbing through the window of her bedroom. I ain't bothered no woman last summer or last fall either, Bigger said. Miss Ashton identified you. She swears you're the one. I don't know nothing about it. But Mrs. Clinton, the sister of the woman you killed last fall, came to your cell and pointed you out. Who'll believe you when you say you didn't do it? You killed and raped two women in 2 days. Who'll believe you when you say you didn't rape and kill the other? Come on, boy. You haven't a chance holding out. I don't know nothing about other women, Bigger repeated stubbornly. Bigger wondered how much did the man really know. Was he lying about the other women in order to get him to tell about Mary and Bessie? Or were they really trying to pin other crimes upon him? Boy, when the newspapers get hold of what we've got on you, you're cooked. I'm not the one who's doing this. The police department is digging up the dirt and bringing it to me. Why don't you talk? Did you kill the other women? Or did somebody make you do it? Was Jan in this business? Were the Reds helping you? You're a fool if Jan was mixed up in this and you won't tell. Bigger shifted his feet and listened to the faint clang of another streetcar passing. The man leaned forward, caught hold of Bigger's arm, and spoke while shaking him. You're hurting nobody but yourself holding out like this, boy. Tell me, were Mary, Bessie, Mrs. Clinton's sister, and Miss Ashton the only women you raped or killed? The words burst out of Bigger. I never heard of no Miss Clinton or Miss Ashton before. Didn't you attack a girl in Jackson Park last summer? No. Didn't you choke and rape a woman on University Avenue last fall? No. Didn't you climb through a window out in Englewood last fall and rape a woman? No, no. I tell you I didn't. You're not telling the truth, boy. Lying won't get you anywhere. I am telling the truth. Whose idea was the kidnap note? Jan's? He didn't have nothing to do with it, said Bigger, feeling a keen desire on the man's part to have him implicate Jan. What's the use of your holding out, boy? Make it easy for yourself. Why not talk and get it over with? They knew he was guilty. They could prove it. If he did not talk, then they would say he had committed every crime they could think of. Boy, why didn't you and your pals rob Blum's store like you planned to last Saturday? Bigger looked at him in surprise. They had found that out, too. You didn't think I knew about that, did you? I know a lot more, boy. I know about that dirty trick you and your friend Jack pulled off in the Regal Theater, too. You wonder how I know it? The manager told us when we were checking up. I know what boys like you do, Bigger. Now, come on. You wrote that kidnap note, didn't you? Yeah, he sighed. I wrote it. Who helped you? Nobody. Who was going to help you to collect the ransom money? Bessie. Come on, was it Jan? No. Bessie? Yeah. Then why did you kill her? Nervously, Bigger's fingers fumbled with a pack of cigarettes and got one out. The man struck a match and held a light for him, but he struck his own match and ignored the offered flame. When I saw I couldn't get the money, I killed her to keep her from talking, he said. And you killed Mary, too? I didn't mean to kill her,
but it don't matter now, he said. Did you lay her? No. You laid Bessie before you killed her. The doctor said so. Now you expect me to believe you didn't lay Mary? I didn't. Did Jan? No. Didn't Jan lay her first and then you? No. No. But Jan wrote the kidnap note, didn't he? I never saw Jan before that night. But didn't he write the note? No, I tell you, he didn't. You wrote the note. Yeah. Didn't Jan tell you to write it? No. Why did you kill Mary? He did not answer. See here, boy. What you say doesn't make sense. You were never in the Dalton home until Saturday night. Yet in one night a girl is raped, killed, burnt, and the next night a kidnap note is sent? Come on. Tell me everything that happened, and about everybody who helped you. There wasn't nobody but me. I don't care what happens to me, but you can't make me say things about other people. But you told Mr. Dalton that Jan was in this thing, too. I was trying to blame it on him. Well, come on. Tell me everything that happened. Bigger rose and went to the window. His hands caught the cold steel bars in a hard grip. He knew as he stood there that he could never tell why he had killed. It was not that he did not really want to tell, but the telling of it would have involved an explanation of his entire life. The actual killing of Mary and Bessie was not what concerned him most. It was knowing and feeling that he could never make anybody know what had driven him to it. His crimes were known, but what he had felt before he committed them would never be known. He would have gladly admitted his guilt if he had thought that in doing so, he could have also given in the same breath a sense of the deep, choking hate that had been his life. A hate that he had not wanted to have, but could not help having. How could he do that? The impulsion to try to tell was as deep as had been the urge to kill. He felt a hand touch his shoulder. He did not turn round. His eyes looked downward and saw the man's gleaming black shoes. I know how you feel, boy. You're colored and you feel that you haven't had a square deal, don't you? The man's voice came low and soft, and Bigger, listening, hated him for telling him what he knew was true. He rested his tired head against the steel bars and wondered how it was possible for this man to know so much about him and yet be so bitterly against him. Maybe you've been brooding about this color question a long time, huh, boy? The man's voice continued low and soft. Maybe you think I don't understand, but I do. I know how it feels to walk along the streets like other people, dressed like them, talking like them, and yet excluded for no reason except that you're black. I know your people. Why, they give me votes out there on the South Side every election. I once talked to a colored boy who raped and killed a woman, just like you raped and killed Mrs. Clinton's sister.
I didn't do it, Bigger screamed.
Why keep saying that? If you talk, maybe the judge will help you. Confess it all and get it over with. You'll feel better. Say, listen. If you tell me everything, I'll see that you're sent to the hospital for an examination, see? If they say you're not responsible, then maybe you won't have to die. Bigger's anger rose. He was not crazy, and he did not want to be called crazy.
I don't want to go to no hospital.
It's a way out for you, boy.
I don't want no way out.
Listen, start at the beginning. Who was the first woman you ever killed?
He said nothing. He wanted to talk, but he did not like the note of intense eagerness in the man's voice. He heard the door behind him open. He turned his head just in time to see another white man look in questioningly.
"I thought you wanted me," the man said.
"Yes, come on in," Buckley said. The man came in and took a seat, holding a pencil and paper on his knee. "Here, Bigger," Buckley said, taking Bigger by the arm. "Sit down here and tell me about it. Get it over with." Bigger wanted to tell how he had felt when Jan had held his hand, how Mary had made him feel when she asked him about how Negroes lived, the tremendous excitement that had hold of him during the day and night he had been in the Dalton home. But there were no words for him. "You went to Mr. Dalton's home at 5:30 that Saturday, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir," he mumbled.
Listlessly, he talked. He traced his every action. He paused at each question Buckley asked, and wondered how he could link up his bare actions with what he had felt. But his words came out flat and dull. White men were looking at him, waiting for his words, and all the feelings of his body vanished, just as they had when he was in the car between Jan and Mary. When he was through, he felt more lost and undone than when he was captured. Buckley stood up. The other white man rose and held out the papers for him to sign. He took the pen in hand. Well, why shouldn't he sign? He was guilty. He was lost. They were going to kill him. Nobody could help him. They were standing in front of him, bending over him, looking at him, waiting. His hand shook. He signed. Buckley slowly folded the papers and put them into his pocket. Bigger looked up at the two men, helplessly, wonderingly. Buckley looked at the other white man and smiled.
"That was not as hard as I thought it would be," Buckley said.
"He came through like a clock," the other man said.
Buckley looked down at Bigger and said,
"Just a scared colored boy from Mississippi."
There was a short silence. Bigger felt that they had forgotten him already. Then he heard them speaking.
"Anything else, Chief?"
"No, I'll be at my club. Let me know how the inquest turns out."
"Okay, Chief."
"So long."
"I'll be seeing you, Chief."
Bigger felt so empty and beaten that he slid to the floor. He heard the feet of the men walking away softly. The door opened and shut. He was alone, profoundly, inescapably. He rolled on the floor and sobbed, wondering what it was that had hold of him, why he was here. He lay on the cold floor sobbing. But really, he was standing up strongly with contrite heart, holding his life in his hands, staring at it with a wondering question. He lay on the cold floor sobbing, but really, he was pushing forward with his puny strength against a world too big and too strong for him. He lay on the cold floor sobbing, but really, he was groping forward with fierce zeal into a welter of circumstances which he felt contained a water of mercy for the thirst of his heart and brain. He wept because he had once again trusted his feelings, and they had betrayed him. Why should he have felt the need to make his feelings known? And why did he not hear resounding echoes of his feelings in the hearts of others? There were times when he did hear echoes, but always they were couched in tones which, living as a Negro, he could not answer or accept without losing face with the world which had first evoked in him the song of manhood. He feared and hated the preacher, because the preacher had told him to bow down and ask for a mercy he knew he needed. But his pride would never let him do that, not this side of the grave, not while the sun shone. And Jan? And Max? They were telling him to believe in himself. Once before, he had accepted completely what his life had made him feel, even unto murder. He had emptied the vessel which life had filled for him, and found the emptying meaningless. Yet the vessel was full again, waiting to be poured out. But no, not blindly this time. He felt that he could not move again unless he swung out from the base of his own feelings. He felt that he would have to have light in order to act now. Gradually, more from a lessening of strength than from peace of soul, his sobs ceased, and he lay on his back, staring at the ceiling. He had confessed, and death loomed now for certain in a public future. How could he go to his death, with white faces looking on and saying that only death would cure him for having flung into their faces his feeling of being black? How could death be victory now? He sighed, pulled up off the floor, and lay on the cot, half awake, half asleep. The door opened, and four policemen came and stood above him. One touched his shoulder. "Come on, boy." He rose and looked at them questioningly. "You're going back to the inquest." They clicked the handcuffs upon his wrists and led him into the hall to a waiting elevator. The doors closed, and he dropped downward through space, standing between four tall, silent men in blue. The elevator stopped. The doors opened, and he saw a restless crowd of people and heard a babble of voices. They led him through a narrow aisle.
"That son of a bitch! Gee, isn't he black? Kill him!"
A hard blow came to his temple, and he slumped to the floor. The faces and voices left him. Pain throbbed in his head, and the right side of his face numbed. He held up an elbow to protect himself. They yanked him back upon his feet. When his sight cleared, he saw policemen struggling with a slender white man. Shouts rose in a mighty roar. To the front of him, a white man pounded with a hammer-like piece of wood upon a table.
"Quiet, or the room will be cleared of everybody except witnesses."
The clamors ceased. The policeman pushed Bigger into a chair. Stretching to the four walls of the room was a solid sheet of white faces. Standing with squared shoulders all round were policemen with clubs in hand, silver metal on their chests, faces red and stern, gray and blue eyes alert. To the right of the man at the table, in rows of three each, six men sat still and silent, their hats and overcoats on their knees. Bigger looked about and saw the pile of white bones lying atop a table. Beside them lay the kidnap note, held in place by a bottle of ink. In the center of the table were white sheets of paper fastened together by a metal clasp. It was his signed confession. And there was Mr. Dalton, white-faced, white-haired. And beside him was Mrs. Dalton, still and straight, her face, as always, tilted trustingly upward to one side. Then he saw the trunk into which he had stuffed Mary's body, the trunk which he had lugged down the stairs and had carried to the station. And yes, there was the blackened hatchet blade and a tiny round piece of metal. Bigger felt a tap on his shoulder and looked round. Max was smiling at him.
"Take it easy, Bigger. You won't have to say anything here. It won't be long."
The man at the front table rapped again.
"Is there a member of the deceased's family here, one who can give us the family history?"
A murmur swept the room. A woman rose hurriedly and went to the blind Mrs. Dalton, caught hold of her arm, led her forward to a seat to the extreme right of the man at the table, facing the six men in the rows of chairs. That must be Mrs. Patterson, Bigger thought, remembering the woman Peggy had mentioned as Mrs. Dalton's maid. "Will you please raise your right hand?" Mrs. Dalton's frail, waxen hand went up timidly. The man asked Mrs. Dalton if the testimony she was about to give was the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. And Mrs. Dalton answered,
"Yes, sir, I do."
Bigger sat stolidly, trying not to let the crowd detect any fear in him. His nerves were painfully taut,
as he hung on to the old woman's words. Under the man's questioning, Mrs. Dalton said that her age was 53, and that she lived at 4605 Drexel Boulevard, that she was a retired schoolteacher, that she was the mother of Mary Dalton, and the wife of Henry Dalton. When the man began asking questions relating to Mary, the crowd leaned forward in their seats. Mrs. Dalton said that Mary was 23 years of age, single, that she carried about $30,000 worth of insurance, that she owned real estate amounting to approximately $250,000, and that she was active right up to the date of her death. Mrs. Dalton's voice came tense and faint, and Bigger wondered how much more of this he could stand. Would it not have been much better to have stood up in the full glare of those roving knives of light and let them shoot him down? He could have cheated them out of this show, this hunt, this eager sport. "Mrs. Dalton," the man said, "I'm the deputy coroner, and it is with considerable anxiety that I ask you these questions. But it is necessary for me to trouble you in order to establish the identity of the deceased."
"Yes, sir,"
Mrs. Dalton whispered. Carefully, the coroner lifted from the table at his side a tiny piece of blackened metal. He turned, fronted Mrs. Dalton, then paused. The room was so quiet that Bigger could hear the coroner's footsteps on the wooden floor as he walked to Mrs. Dalton's chair. Tenderly, he caught her hand in his and said, "I'm placing in your hand a metal object, which the police retrieved from the ashes of the furnace in the basement of your home. Mrs. Dalton, I want you to feel this metal carefully, and tell me if you remember ever having felt it before." Bigger wanted to turn his eyes away, but he could not. He watched Mrs. Dalton's face. He saw the hand tremble that held the blackened bit of metal. Bigger jerked his head round. A woman began to sob without restraint. A wave of murmurs rose through the room. The coroner took a quick step back to the table and rapped sharply with his knuckles. The room was instantly quiet, save for the sobbing woman. Bigger looked back to Mrs. Dalton. Both of her hands were now fumbling nervously with the piece of metal. Then her shoulders shook. She was crying. "Do you recognize it?"
Yes.
"What is it?"
An earring.
"When did you first come in contact with it?" Mrs. Dalton composed her face, and with tears on her cheeks, answered,
"When I was a girl, years ago."
"Do you remember precisely when?"
35 years ago.
"You once owned it?"
"Yes. It was one of a pair."
"Yes, Mrs. Dalton. No doubt the other earring was destroyed in the fire. This one dropped through the grates into the bin under the furnace. Now, Mrs. Dalton, how long did you own this pair of earrings?"
"For 33 years.
"How did they come into your possession?"
"Well, my mother gave them to me when I was of age. My grandmother gave them to my mother when she was of age, and I in turn gave them to my daughter when she was of age."
"What do you mean, of age?"
"At 18.
"And when did you give them to your daughter?"
"About 5 years ago.
"She wore them all the time?"
"Yes."
"Are you positive that this is one of the same earrings?"
"Yes, there can be no mistake. They were a family heirloom. There are no two others like them. My grandmother had them designed and made to order."
"Mrs. Dalton, when were you last in the company of the deceased?"
"Last Saturday night, or I should say, early Sunday morning."
"At what time?"
"It was nearly 2 o'clock, I think."
"Where was she?"
"In her room, in bed."
Were you in the habit of seeing, I mean, in the habit of meeting your daughter at such an hour?
No. I knew that she'd planned to go to Detroit Sunday morning. When I heard her come in, I wanted to find out why she'd stayed out so late.
Did you speak with her?
No. I called her several times, but she did not answer.
Did you touch her?
Yes, slightly.
But she did not speak to you?
Well, I heard some mumbling.
Do you know who it was?
No.
Mrs. Dalton, could your daughter, by any means, in your judgment, have been dead then, and you not have known or suspected it?
I don't know.
Do you know if your daughter was alive when you spoke to her?
I don't know. I assumed she was.
Was there anyone else in the room at the time?
I don't know. But I felt strange there.
Strange? What do you mean, strange?
I don't know. I wasn't satisfied for some reason. It seemed to me that there was something I should have done or said, but I kept saying to myself, she's asleep, that's all.
If you felt so dissatisfied, why did you leave the room without trying to awaken her? Mrs. Dalton paused before answering. Her thin mouth was wide open, and her face tilted far to one side.
I smelt alcohol in the room,
she whispered. Yes?
I thought Mary was intoxicated.
Had you ever encountered your daughter intoxicated before?
Yes. And that was why I thought she was intoxicated then. It was the same odor.
Mrs. Dalton, if someone had possessed your daughter sexually while she lay on that bed, could you in any way have detected it? The room buzzed. The coroner rapped for order.
I don't know,
she whispered. Just a few more questions, please, Mrs. Dalton. What aroused your suspicions that something had befallen your daughter?
When I went to her room the next morning, I felt her bed and found that she had not slept in it. Next, I felt in her clothes rack and found that she had not taken the new clothes she had bought.
Mrs. Dalton, you and your husband have given large sums of money to Negro educational institutions, haven't you?
Yes.
Could you tell us roughly how much?
Over $5 million.
You bear no ill will toward the Negro people?
No, none whatever.
Mrs. Dalton, please, tell us what was the last thing you did when you stood above your daughter's bed that Sunday morning? She paused, lowered her head, and dabbed at her eyes.
I knelt at the bedside and prayed,
she said, her words coming in a sharp breath of despair. That is all. Thank you, Mrs. Dalton. The room heaved a sigh. Bigger saw the woman lead Mrs. Dalton back to her seat. Many eyes in the room were fastened upon Bigger now, cold gray and blue eyes. Eyes whose tense hate was worse than a shout or a curse. To get rid of that concentrated gaze, he stopped looking, even though his eyes remained open. The coroner turned to the men sitting in rows to his right and said, "You gentlemen, the jurors, are any of you acquainted with the deceased, or are any of you members of the family?" One of the men rose and said, "No, sir." "Would there be any reason,
why you could not render a fair and impartial verdict in this.
No, sir.
Is there any objection to these men serving as jurors in this case? The coroner asked of the entire room. There was no answer. In the name of the coroner, I will ask the jurors to rise, pass by this table, and view the remains of the deceased, one Mary Dalton. In silence, the six men rose and filed past the table, each looking at the pile of white bones. When they were seated again, the coroner called. We will now hear Mr. Jan Erlon. Jan rose, came forward briskly, and was asked to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help him God. Bigger wondered if Jan would turn on him now. He wondered if he could really trust any white man, even this white man who had come and offered him his friendship. He leaned forward to hear. Jan was asked several times if he was a foreigner, and Jan said no. The coroner walked close to Jan's chair and leaned the upper part of his body forward and asked in a loud voice, "Do you believe in social equality for Negroes?" The room stirred.
"I believe all races are equal," Jan began.
"Answer yes or no, Mr. Erlon. You're not on a soapbox. Do you believe in social equality for Negroes?"
"Yes."
"Are you a member of the Communist Party?"
"Yes."
"In what condition was Miss Dalton when you left her last Sunday morning?"
"What do you mean?"
"Was she drunk?"
"I would not say she was drunk. She had had a few drinks."
"What time did you leave her?"
"It was about 1:30, I think."
"Was she in the front seat of the car?"
"Yes, she was in the front seat."
"Had she been in the front seat all along?"
"No."
"Was she in the front seat when you left the cafe?"
"No."
"Did you put her in the front seat when you left the car?"
"No. She said she wanted to sit up front."
"You didn't ask her to?"
"No."
"When you left her, was she able to get out of the car alone?"
"I think so."
"Had you had any relations with her while in the back seat that would have tended to make her, let us say, stunned, too weak to have gotten out alone?"
"No."
"Is it not true, Mr. Erlon, that Miss Dalton was in no condition to protect herself and you lifted her into that front seat?"
"No, I didn't lift her into the front seat."
Jen's voice sounded throughout the room. There was a quick buzzing of conversation. "Why did you leave an unprotected white girl alone in a car with a drunken Negro?"
"I was not aware that Bigger was drunk, and I did not consider Mary as being unprotected."
"Had you at any time in the past left Miss Dalton alone in the company of Negroes?"
"No."
"You had never used Miss Dalton as bait before, had you?" Bigger was startled by a noise behind him. He turned his head. Max was on his feet. "Mr. Coroner, I realize that this is not a trial, but the questions being asked now have no earthly relation to the cause and manner of the death of the deceased." "Mr. Max, we are allowing plenty of latitude here. The grand jury will determine whether the testimony offered here has any relation or not. But questions of this sort inflame the public mind. Now listen, Mr. Max. No question asked in this room will inflame the public mind any more than has the death of Mary Dalton, and you know it. You have the right to question any of these witnesses, but I will not tolerate any publicity seeking by your kind here. But Mr. Erlon is not on trial here, Mr. Coroner. He is suspected of being implicated in this murder. And we're after the one who killed this girl and the reasons for it. If you think these questions have the wrong construction, You may question the witness when we're through, but you cannot regulate the questions asked here.
Max sat down. The room was quiet. The coroner paced to and fro a few seconds before he spoke again. His face was red, and his lips were pressed tight.
Mr. Erlone, didn't you give that Negro material relating to the Communist Party?
Yes.
What was the nature of that material?
I gave him some pamphlets on the Negro question.
Material advocating the equality of whites and blacks.
It was material which explained...
Did that material contain a plea for unity of whites and blacks?
Why, yes.
Did you, in your agitation of that drunken Negro, tell him that it was all right for him to have sexual relations with white women?
No.
Did you advise Miss Dalton to have sexual relations with him?
No.
Did you shake hands with that Negro?
Yes.
Did you offer to shake hands with him?
Yes.
It is what any decent person... Confine yourself to answering the questions, please, Mr. Erlone. We want none of your communist explanations here. Tell me, did you eat with that Negro?
Why, yes.
You invited him to eat?
Yes.
Miss Dalton was at the table when you invited him to sit down?
Yes.
How many times have you eaten with Negroes before?
I don't know, many times.
You like Negroes?
I make no distinctions.
Do you like Negroes, Mr. Erlone?
I object, Max shouted. How on earth is that related to this case?
You cannot regulate these questions, the coroner shouted. I've told you that before. A woman has been foully murdered. This witness brought the deceased into contact with the last person who saw her alive. We have the right to determine what this witness's attitude was toward that girl and that Negro.
The coroner turned back to Jan.
Now, Mr. Erlone, didn't you ask that Negro to sit in the front seat of the car between you and Miss Dalton?
No. He was already in the front seat.
But you didn't ask him to get into the back seat, did you?
No.
Why didn't you?
My God! The man is human. Why don't you ask me?
I'm asking these questions and you're answering them. Now tell me, Mr. Erlone, would you have invited that Negro to sleep with you?
I refuse to answer that question.
But you didn't refuse that drunken Negro the right to sleep with that girl, did you?
His right to associate with her or anybody else was not in question.
Did you try to keep that Negro from Miss Dalton?
I didn't.
Answer yes or no.
No.
Have you a sister?
Why, yes.
Where is she?
In New York.
Is she married?
No.
Would you consent for her to marry a Negro?
I have nothing to do with whom she marries.
Didn't you tell that drunken Negro to call you Jan instead of Mr. Erlone?
Yes, but
confine yourself to answering the questions.
But Mr. Coroner, you imply...
I'm trying to establish a motive for the murder of that innocent girl.
No, you're not. You're trying to indict a race of people and a political party.
We want no statements. Tell me, was Miss Dalton in a condition to say goodbye to you when you left her in that car with the drunken Negro?
Yes. She said goodbye.
Tell me, how much liquor did you give Miss Dalton that night?
I don't know.
What kind of liquor was it?